It's been said that it's impossible to hate someone whose story you know. That's why stories matter, because they show us that we have more in common than we realize. My name is Bindu Lokre, co-founder of Consciously Unbiased, and I'm your host for this special Break the Bias podcast mini-series that is all about sharing and listening to each other's stories.
Some things happen so that other things can happen. You know, I was absolutely meant to be a therapist, and if I wasn't so misunderstood in my adolescence and had parents who loved me but weren't taught that emotional intelligence, I wouldn't have sought that in my adulthood, right? If I wasn't so insistent on being a performative Black person, I wouldn't have, like, embraced my Blackness and seen the benefits of it and sought that out in my adult years later.
In this episode, we're delighted to have the extraordinary Bea Arthur, a Columbia University-trained psychotherapist, award-winning entrepreneur, TEDx speaker, and pioneer in the e-therapy space, as the first African-American female founder accepted by Y Combinator. Bea was named an entrepreneur to bet on by Newsweek magazine and one of the 100 most inspirational New Yorkers by Bumble. She is the founder and CEO of The Difference, the first on-demand therapy service for in-the-moment issues. Bea takes us on a fascinating journey of resilience and transformation, from being a rebellious young person who got kicked out of school to becoming an influential therapist and founder of a tech company. She shares candid narratives about her personal struggles, including clashes with authority and her journey towards embracing her Blackness. Bea talks about navigating the tech industry as a Black woman founder, dealing with VC funding challenges, and her innovative company, The Difference, that offers a unique form of therapy. We'll touch on topics of mental health stigma, the power of human connection, diversity and inclusion, and the importance of laughter as a form of relief. We hope you enjoy the show.
First, I want to go back to your teenage self.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions.
I'm ready.
Okay. Student council or a loner?
Student council. Mm.
Teacher's pet or detention?
Detention. Both can be true.
Theater or athlete?
Kind of half-assed at both of them.
Okay. Why?
I got kicked off of the tennis team, and I was, even though I'm very dramatic, was not cast for any major roles in theater. So I just kind of showed up and just got my jokes off and fucked around.
Okay, honor student or barely getting by?
Honor student. I was very big on that. Mm. First generation African Ghanaian American kids, so, you know, we're big on education for sure.
Tell me about that. Tell me about being a child of immigrants and kind of, you know, where you came from. This is like, this little rapid fire kind of told me a little bit about what was important to you and your values, but how has that shifted you and shaped you into who you are and what you're doing now, which is so awesome. I can't wait to talk about that.
Thank you. Yeah, everything I am is being, you know, a third culture kid. You know, I was the first one born in this country. Mm-hmm. Both of my parents are from Ghana and West Africa, but my older brothers and my older sister were born there, but my little sister and I were the first one born here. And we were born in Houston, Texas.
Ooh.
So dual-edged sword. On the one hand, it's fucking Texas, right?
Yep.
Pre-Abbott Texas. It was a different place, but also still Texas, you know, and I wasn't gifted and talented my whole life. So I was often the only, you know, raisin in the rice pudding, you know, often. And, but then I also, you know, Houston is also where Beyonce is from. Yeah. Houston is where Megan Thee Stallion is from. Lizzo, Felicia Rashad, Debbie Allen. So like, it's really like powerful land as far as like just Southern girls. And it's a really great place because it's, even though it's like kind of racist, it's very diverse, you know, because of the oil there and because of all the medicine. It has one of the best cancer centers in the country. You have a lot of immigrants. So big Vietnamese population, Iranian, Indian. So diversity was good. Also, my mom is an entrepreneur. Like, my older sister is an entrepreneur. She started her first company when I was 12. So we witnessed the unglamorous parts of it. So I was aware of what it took. A lot of people get into entrepreneurship and they're like, I can't wait to not work for myself and this and that. Yeah. No, I know what it's like to stretch bills and stretch meals because I watched my mommy do it, but I also knew that it was possible. Wow. Right? So that was just a normal thing to me. And then Texas was a little bit hard for me. I got kicked out of my first high school. So when you're like, yeah, I was really
okay.
Bad.
What's the story on that?
Oh my God. I kind of earned it. So
earned it. I love
kind
that it's,
of earned
you know,
it. Yeah.
Earn it. Own it.
Yeah, I did all of those things. It was me, officer. Yeah, I did all those things. So I, like I said, gifted and talented my whole life since like third grade. But my parents worked a lot because immigrants' parents worked a lot. And so I lied to get my first job when I was 15, paid for my own car when I was 16. And of course, because my parents weren't home and I've been raising myself, and as long as my grades were good, they didn't give me too much fluff. So I just did what I want, including like had my own money. So it was just all over the place. I didn't respect or listen to authority. They told me I was going to, I was making good grades, but my behavior was like, you know, S, P, U, which is unsatisfactory, you know? And, but my thing is I've always been very charming. So whenever I'd get sent to the principal's office, there were two vice principals who took a liking to me. And I'd just be like, oh, Miss Daniels, I don't know why the teachers don't understand. You know, they'd be like, you're just misunderstood. I was like, right? And like the teachers were like, you're not going to get away with this, you know, and I just learned early on, you know, like how to talk to adults, you know. So, yeah, I was not I was a good student, but I really just have never respected rules for no reason, which lends itself well to entrepreneurship. But the reason I got kicked out is, as you can see, got this banging body. I developed really early. So I got a lot of dress code violations. And, you know, and but even now when I grow up and I think about it, like, just I don't have a problem with my body. Just adults have a problem with my body, right? So Imagine that pressure that was put on a young child to be aware of my body, right? But it's also the reason I became a therapist. You know, my parents are African, and in Africa, kids are really obedient, you know, and I was not. You know, they raised me around white kids, so what did you expect, right? Like, I became a little bitty Karen at, like, 10, you know? Truly, I was just like, oh, I want to be a white girl. I want to be, like, these white girls, right? And so I just didn't listen to my parents. And I just thought I knew everything. But so when I went through puberty, it was really hard for them because, one, yeah, I got this banging ass body, but I also got like terrible suicidal thoughts, right? Terrible rages, right? And, you know, looking back, I have so much empathy for my parents because like they didn't know what to do with me or how to talk to me, but neither did I, you know? And so when I went to grad school, I ended up going to Columbia for my master's. I also studied adolescent psychology just because they're such formative years, right? It's their first time out here. They're kids with big feelings, you know, and parents forget, you know, what it's like to go through hormones, you know, like think about pregnant ladies and you know how they're always getting confused, you know? Like that for little kids, you know, with these big feelings, you know. And so it's interesting though, because once I went to college, it all fell away. Like I was on time, I got my own internships, unpaid internships, because people took me seriously. People treated me like an adult. People took my feelings seriously. And also there was immediate consequences. Like there was no like, why are you doing that? Da da da. They're like, oh, you didn't turn it in, you're gonna fail, you know. So I don't know. I think we don't give kids with big feelings enough credit and enough space and grace to kind of process that.
Yeah.
So I've done that for myself as an adult and for my clients now as a therapist.
Okay. Did you feel like your parents gave you the space to kind of feel those big thoughts when you were growing up? Were they supportive of it? Or did they still have that, you know, that immigrant philosophy of why are you not staying in this lane? Yeah. Like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, it was very tough for them. Even now, like, really spoil my parents. So, no, they didn't give me any space.
Yeah.
No, they didn't mine talk to me about my feelings.
No, yeah,
like,
yeah.
What is that? Like, they didn't want to hear it. You
have feelings?
Yeah, literally. You know, and when I was raised, like, kids were meant to be seen and not heard, you know, and that's it. So, I feel like for me, my parents just really didn't know why I wasn't a good kid. But I made good grades. And my dad, I actually think this is good. My dad became very dismissive, very cold, right? I understood the nature of conditional love very often. I think a lot of immigrant kids, you know, like when we look at our white friends, I'm like, wow, your parents love you no matter what. You
know? Like mine didn't love me today.
They made a point of telling me and shaming me, all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And my dad, if it wasn't about school, he like didn't talk to me for like kind of like the last 2 years of high school. He was like, I don't suffer fools. Like you want to act like a fool? I'm not going to engage with it, right?
Wow.
But I almost like, okay, cool, you know? And then my mom's like me. She's very dramatic. She's very vain. I remember one day I had gotten kicked out of my first high school. I remember I applied. I was trying to be on the cheerleading squad. And, you know, obviously it seems like I'd be a cheerleader.
Yeah.
But in Texas, it's considered a privilege. So like your teachers have to say you deserve the privilege. And out of 8 teachers, 0 said, you're supposed to have 4, 0 said. Because I was just really disruptive in class. I was rude. I talked back. And then I'm leaving out a key part, which is that I threw a tape dispenser at my teacher. So, well, not at my teacher, at the door that he was behind. And then like, then they kicked
me out. But was it meant for him?
Yeah, I was not in my right mind. I was like a very emotional kid. And and I was there on a magnet. I was not zoned to that school. Mm. So after they were like, yeah, you got to go. And then the school that I was zoned to wasn't very good. So then I went to private school, which was a very small school. I was the only black kid in my class, let alone like in the whole class, not just black girl, black kid, and everybody had been there since kindergarten. So it was like the nerds ruled that school. It was Revenge of the Nerds. So here I was, like, this, like, friendly cheerleader. They were so mean to me. The teachers were mean to me. And for that reason, but thankfully, I was on the first thing smoking out of Texas. That's what made me leave Texas. And I went to Boston for undergrad and then Columbia for my master's. And so it all happens, you know, it's all fertilizer.
So that was kind of like in your high school.
That was my high school experience. I came out swinging, yeah.
So that must have been such a transition, though, because you went from a pretty diverse, it sounds like, school, and then you moved into a smaller school where you were the only black girl.
They treated me so bad, too.
So, and it sounded like you kind of, like, felt like there were times where you just wanted to assimilate into white culture, and then you were this black girl, and you were trying to figure out how to succeed with the nerds. What's your favorite thing about being black? Like, did you feel that as a kid, or do you feel it now that you kind of feel like you're so much more comfortable sharing and not hiding anymore?
Absolutely. Like, even recently, up until COVID, I knew not to wear braids, like, if I knew I was going to be at certain work events, you know? Like, I didn't wear braids for years because I just... the thing about having white friends is they will say stuff around you, like, you're real white friends. So I knew how to perform, right? I knew what not to do, how to not be ghetto, how to be, like, a truly assimilated African-American, right? I understood that from an early level. If you're raised in shame, something is wired in you where you learn how to avoid that, right? Mm-hmm. All of our behavior is goal-oriented. So it wasn't until I actually went to grad school, because then I went to undergrad in Boston, mind you, even less diverse. but also all of these things, when I was a therapist, I would tell my clients, you know, like, they used to hate it when people would say, everything happens for a reason, everything happens for a reason. But I always explain that, like, Americans have misinterpreted that. Americans have a very strong culture of avoidance and, like, just making everything nice and happy. And so people think it means everything happens for a good reason. No, that's not true. Some things happen so that other things can happen. Yeah. You know, I was absolutely meant to be a therapist. And if I wasn't so misunderstood in my adolescence and had parents who loved me but weren't taught that emotional intelligence, I wouldn't have sought that in my adulthood, right? If I wasn't so insistent on being a performative black person, I wouldn't have, like, embraced my blackness and seen the benefits of it and sought that out in my adult years later. If Texas wasn't so fucking racist, I wouldn't have gotten the fuck out and came to New York where I was obviously meant to be. Yeah. So you know what? I don't regret any of it. It's all fertilizer. So,
No, I'm with you. I had a very similar background too, where I came from a really small town outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We are South Asian, and it was me and it was my brother, and that was it.
Damn.
There might have been one black person in my entire middle school and high school combined.
Whoa.
So that was something that I felt like, as with immigrant parents coming in, my father was a physician and he really had to make a name for us. And the socioeconomic privilege that we had gave us the confidence that we needed to feel like we could succeed that way. But God, when it was time to leave, I was like, I need to get the fuck out of Dodge because
you can't do it anymore.
You just need to be surrounded by different perspective.
Yes.
Yeah. So I get that. I get that. But I think it's so important because it also shows how you can work within so many different dynamics of communities.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And your values still can be consistent with what it was then and how they shift into what you want to be.
Exactly. I mean, diversity goes both ways, you know, like I am better because I've been exposed to white culture, white American culture. I'm better because I lived in Europe. I'm better because I spent time in Boston. I'm definitely better because I've been in New York, but not just racial and cultural, but also like age diversity. I have friends who are older than me, friends who are younger than me that have just, you know, that's the whole thing we teach in therapy is that perspective is the ultimate privilege, right? If you can see something from a different vantage point, you will win, right? Versus somebody who's kind of like stuck in that kind of like wiring and frame. So yeah, whatever it takes to get it, I'll take it.
I love what you said about everything happens for a reason, right? When I think about that, it's this idea of we all go through, whether it's trauma or it's some sort of transitional period in our lives. And if we don't acknowledge it and we don't showcase it and figure out how to grow past it, then we're stuck, right?
Yeah, you're
stuck. That's how you get to that everything happens for a reason piece. And yes, it doesn't have to be good all the time, but it is something that has built upon your character.
Exactly.
Year over year.
I read this great book. I'm really into plant medicine now. Mm-hmm. I did ayahuasca a few years ago during COVID because it was definitely life-changing. Yeah. I highly recommend. It's not for everybody, but like at least do mushrooms or something. Because just like you're saying,
everyone keeps telling me that.
Yeah,
everyone
it's a great release. Like you have a happy hunger, but just like you're saying, like you're able to get distance from things. Like there's stuff in this room that we can't see right now, right? But when you do mushrooms, you see, right? So it helps you from like overly focusing on your problems or like one way, because there's so much more, you know, that we can't see that we know is coming, you know, just a lot more than just this moment, which is just a nice way to live. But yeah, when I did ayahuasca, I read this book called Where Two Worlds Touch, and it's about spiritual rites of passage. Mm-hmm. And she has this line where she says, every soul, like your capital S soul, chooses their challenges to tailor their personality for their purpose.
Wow. Wait, can you say that again?
I will.
Please.
Every soul chooses their challenges to tailor their personality for their purpose.
That is so beautiful.
And it's true. I've seen people who were like abandoned and they learned independence, right? Yeah. Like I used to only date rich guys because, again, you see the tits. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to use everything. I'm leaving here with something, right? But those rich guys will like hang money over your head and treat you like, you know what I mean? And after that, I insisted that I was going to always be financially independent. And I know people are stuck in that. So there's sometimes like, I don't like to say, and there is trauma, absolutely. But now, you know, on TikTok, they say everything is trauma.
Yeah.
So I prefer to reframe it as, not, don't just think of it as trauma, but think of it as a transformative experience. Now that I know this, I can move this way. Now that I've seen this, I know that this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I try to use everything for my benefit. I always say, if you're going to go through hell, get something from the gift shop.
Totally.
Yeah.
I love that.
I didn't do this for nothing. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's like the idea of a push present or anything like that. You know what? Just treat yourself.
Treat yourself. I want double for my trouble. I'm not just going to have the scar. I want a tattoo over it. Yeah. I want a cool hat.
Yeah. Maybe a little gem.
Yeah.
Some jewels.
Stop and have a drinky poo.
Yes. I'm going to rethink that too when I think about my scars.
Oh, yeah. Celebrate at life. Like get to the top of the mountain and look back at everything you did to get
there.
It
is. It's your battlefield of life.
It's amazing. Yeah. I'm so impressed. Like, I mean, especially when you come through in corporate or tech and being the only woman, being the only brown person, you fight so many battles, you know, like really celebrate your accomplishments. You really, that is a natural antidote to shame as pride, right? Mm-hmm. Remembering where you came from, what it took, and only you got yourself through it. And it's a really good form of self-love that I try to give myself.
Okay, so I gotta ask you, because you're the founder of The Difference, and we're going to talk about that because I have so many questions about that. But the role that you're playing right now as being a founder, as being a Black woman who clearly can come to the table and share so much of herself, which I think is so authentic and amazing. Mm. Do you find it challenging while you're out there looking for VC funding and everything like that? Or is it a benefit?
It's so interesting because, you know, pre-show, we were talking about a recent VC experience.
Yep.
And, you know, I was the first Black woman in Y Combinator, like way back in summer 14 with my previous company. I've been on Shark Tank. I've built products for Amazon and MetLife. I've been in like every magazine. And when you go into these VC meetings, they will act like you just fell off the turnip truck. Like it's such a disorienting, like mind fuck. There's no other way, right? And it really, in my early years in startup, it was really tough, right? Because I believed them. It's like with kids, we have to watch the way we talk to kids too, because if somebody is in a position of authority, you trust them. You were taught to trust them, to believe them, even over what you know to be true, right? And so I was like making money and being on TV, and these VCs would still be like, it's too early, or da 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 da. And meanwhile, like I've had book deals, you know, things that I didn't have to work for, like other people see my value, but these people don't. And my coach actually taught me this, that's what the word respect means. It comes from spectare, to see. And unfortunately, in this world, they will never see me, right? Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how much conviction or traction I have, like I will always have to convince them. And so the good thing is, because I haven't been as successful with VC funding, I'm still a business person. Whether I'm a startup founder or not, I'm a hustler. I will always eat. And I know that about myself. And it's one of the things that made my journey a lot better, because if I would have gotten money early, I would have been building in a vacuum. But I've been building in the trenches, right? Like I have had to consult. So I've got to consult for Nike. Like I said, all these really big companies. And I've learned what's happening. I go on panels. You know, I'm really connected to other people in the psychology technology space. And the knowledge that I got just from like, and also I had to be profit focused first, right? I wouldn't just take 5 years and $5 million and just tinker.
Yeah.
And then the product is expired. So I feel very lucky in that I know how to do business deals, if not VC term sheets and all that stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, it's given me, I can reflect back, like, I've generated money. You know, like, some people have millions of dollars and get, like, how many, like, 1,000 unpaid users. Like, I've paid myself, I paid people, like, you know, I've been in plates. And only I can, you know, so nobody else can take credit for my success. So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was hard fought, but, like, once I realized, like, oh, it's not going to come from here, who else is going to see me?
Yeah.
And
see you for who you are,
yeah,
right?
And
it's
see the
like
value.
You're finding your audience.
Right,
who's gonna
exactly.
Who's going to support your passion and your drive. And it's going to be because, like, people want to invest in you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing, it's kind of like in Thor, you know, I love that Chris Hemsworth. So, you know, in Thor, where the one with Cate Blanchett, and she's like his crazy half-sister or something. And at the end of the movie, he's like, we can't beat her here. Like, here on that planet, like, they had to blow up the whole planet because this bitch was so bad. She can't be beaten on her term. And I really identified with that. I was like, that's me. Like, when I'm connected and aligned and in source and in my power, I can't be beat. So, fuck what they talking about.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. Okay, so tell me about the difference.
Yes, my baby. So the difference is my baby. It's we believe the right talk at the right time can make all the difference. And yeah, the whole premise of it is we connected with a live licensed human therapist in 30 minutes or less by phone. So we call them professional pep talks. So you can just text the word pep talk to our phone number. And then we go, okay, here we have calls at 1-3-5. And then you book an appointment time and we call you back on your phone. So we just wanted to guarantee same day sessions. And again, some things happen so other things can happen. The reason I came up with this concept is because after my last company closed after 5 years, which was really tough, I was really suicidal because, like I said, this is the longest job I'd ever had. It was the most money I'd made. It was what I was known for. You know, I think I was like 27 to 32 or 26 to 31. So it was a really tough loss. And in my last year, and I got evicted. I mean, I gave it everything. In my last year, I call the suicide hotline 4 times, and I'm okay with talking about it because I'm a therapist and I can understand that my body didn't want to die, but my heart wanted the pain to stop. You know, and that's a fair space to give myself. And sometimes when I called the suicide hotline, they were terrible, right? And sometimes they were really good. But in 20 or 30 minutes, I could say what was on my mind. I could get the energy out of my body and I could at least get through that day. And by the 4th time I called, I was like, God, this is so good. Like, there should be a way to do this when you're not in crisis.
Yeah.
So that's what the difference is. I trained a bunch of therapists as call center agents, and we just guarantee same day sessions. I think of it as preventative mental health care instead. And that's why we call professional pep talks. And so even though it's been like a long journey, I've been in this space for over 10 years. Also, people weren't ready for mental health. When I started in 2011, the stigma was still there. And finally, when COVID came, everybody's home and depressed.
Yeah, totally.
And finally, all those VCs who didn't see the vision, everybody's hitting me up and being like, wait, weren't you saying something about this for the last 10 years? So yeah, my coach says I'm too pretty to be petty. So I'm just like, yeah, I was right. I'm glad y'all caught up. You know, like that's the loneliness of being a visionary sometimes. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. So walk us through how it works.
Yes. So with the difference, I staff therapists. They work in 3-hour shifts, 9 to noon, noon to 3, et cetera. And then, yeah, if you're just having a tough day, if you had a tough call, it can be something as petty as just like a fight with your friend or something as serious as like a recent loss. And yeah, you just text pep talk to our number. You have to enter your code on our site to get our number. And yeah, we have therapists staffed all day and we'll just call you on your phone. And we call it a pep talk pack. Mm-hmm. And you can just like call in for just 30-minute sessions. And if you like one of the trainers that you land on, then you can upgrade to the partner track, and then you have exclusive access to your therapist calendar, and you can just book directly with them.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I know when I was trying to find a therapist
years ago,
it's so hard.
It's
and you have to, like, go through the process of having these conversations to see if you're connecting with them first,
mm-hmm.
but then it takes a good, I don't know.
3-4 sessions.
Yeah, at least, right?
Yeah.
To feel like you're getting there. And then it's hard to shift it. So that's where I was curious. do you have that ability to kind of continue with the same person?
So that's what it is for us. We think of it as like matchmaking for the caller and lead gen for the therapist. Mm-hmm. Because like, I don't think therapy works if the therapist isn't right for you, right?
Yeah.
Because they could have the cure for cancer, but if you don't like and trust them, you will not get to that place of peace and perspective and clarity and stuff that you really need in that kind of partnership relationship.
Yeah, for sure. So is it something like, is it B2C? Can I go to sign up for it? Or
soon
is
you
it
will.
Through? Okay.
So we are technically B2B2C. So we have gone to market through non-employer-based marketplaces because a lot of therapists don't take health insurance, and 77% of therapists, in fact, don't take insurance. They make it really hard. Your insurance companies make it very hard for you to get paid.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I would have to chase like a $60 invoice for reimbursement for 3 months, you know, just for $60. Or I could just charge a rich person $300 an hour, you know, cash, no tax. So to everybody who's looking for a therapist, it's not the therapist's fault, unfortunately. The cock-blocking insurance industry has made it really hard for both sides of the marketplace. So what I did is I created a co-op of therapists. So we pay them a flat $70 an hour. We do revenue sharing quarterly. That way we make sure there's really good therapists because there's a lot of bad therapists out there. So we really curate really heavily on the supply side. We train them on what we call a mental strength skills framework. And yeah, we've just made it separate. And we go to market through non-employer-based marketplaces. So co-working spaces, schools, gyms, social clubs, that kind of thing. And then you get like a discount through them, but then you can also sign up as an individual. It's just like a little bit more expensive.
Okay. Is it like a monthly fee?
It's a monthly fee, but we're changing to bundles. So you can just like buy little bundles and just use them whenever.
That's so great because that is the one thing about therapy. You know, I feel like at the beginning when I was going through it, everybody that was talking to me about, oh, you need to get a therapist. It was from this like level of privilege.
Of course.
It is such a barrier.
It's so crazy. Like it's, and I see it really badly with some therapists, like in therapist groups. And I'm like, this is just bad business practice. Like, yes, of course you should value your worth and your school. And we have like a lot of fees and unpaid labor for sure. But you can only work with rich people. Like I had a therapist I loved, but she was like $800 a month. Yeah. And even though I was better every time I talked to her, it made me want to fight her. I was like, this is insane, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just, there's just got to be a way for it to be more affordable. I think if we make it easier and cheaper, like it'll be stickier, right? More people will use it.
Yeah.
More people will be walking around with carrying less stuff. Cause that's the thing. Like we just want you to like, I always say we fluff you down and then we lift you up so you can just get on with your day.
Okay. So you said schools.
Yes. Huge on that.
Is this
Little B
level?
Is cheering for me. Yeah. So we can, so there's COPPA laws, which means you can only interact with children up to the age of 15. They have to be at least 15.
Okay.
And so when we go to market with schools, we actually worked with Google Education to design an SEL, a social and emotional learning program, because there needs to be a lot of emotional literacy. School doesn't teach them how to be a happy, healthy human. No. And that is exactly what I needed growing up. And the teachers are suffering. The parents don't know what to do now. I mean, it's just such a different generation. Yeah. And like I said, all I wanted was to be seen. Like, I mean, they doped me up. When I went to, I didn't mention this, but before I got kicked out, I couldn't charm the VP, the vice principals anymore, right?
So that was your limit?
That was like, it. After I did the change of special, they were like, listen here. You're really making us look bad, girl. You got to get up out of here. And I had a nurse who I had also charmed. And she was like, you know what? I think you have bipolar disorder. And my parents, like I said, they started business. We have assisted living centers in Houston. And so they've seen the consequences of over-medicating someone. Mm-hmm. And also, like, you technically can't be diagnosed until you're 18. You're still developing, you know. And so when I see people, like, pumping kids with medicine, like, before their brains are formed, before their hormonal process is complete, it's problematic. But my parents, they told my parents, if she doesn't get on antidepressants, we're going to kick her out. So like they put me on 50 milligrams of Zoloft. My mom couldn't even look when I would take it because again, this is her child. Like even though I was like rowdy, like she didn't want to see me become a zombie,
you know,
which is what she worked with every day. I got on antidepressants and then I threw the tape dispenser and I got kicked out anyway.
So she's like, this doesn't work.
In my
Can
mind,
we
I was
return
like,
this?
I'll never do medication again. And then I became a pothead. Because I am so upset about, like, to this day, I'm like, wow. Like, and when I look back or, you know, people think, you know, just kids who can't sit still. No kid can sit still.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, why are you? And guess what happened? You know, our generation, everybody was on Ritalin. And guess what happened? We all grew up and did coke, you know. When we moved to New York, which I did, you know. And I feel like if anybody had just, like, asked me what was going on, and even me, you know, when my favorite year ever was when I was in grad school and I did my practicum at a New York City public high school. And people think city kids kids are just like so grown up. No, they know how to avoid homeless people and like how to get somebody to buy them a drink, but they still make the same dumb decisions as other kids, right?
Totally.
And I love working with kids because when you work with adults, you know, they've, you know, worked really hard to keep up all their walls, but kids are so vain. They love talking about themselves, you know? So I always just wanted to make sure I gave back to that time. You know, it's such a special time. It's when you're leaving your tribe of your family of origin, your original parent tribe to your peers, which, you know, have so much power and you're just figuring it out. And it's, I don't know, I think just a time that should be respected and safe and protected and explored. So I'm really big on giving back to the kids. I'm actually speaking at a ZEO, Gen Z, doing a ZEO conference in the fall. And yeah, we're just going to start rolling out the SEL program. So I'm really excited about
that. That is so exciting. I mean, first of all, they're always on their phone anyways. Yeah, so might as well use it for good.
Yeah. And they can call as well. And it's not text because I feel like it's the most impersonal way to communicate. And it's not video because people are zoomed out. Yep. And it's hard to talk about bad things while somebody's looking at you. And what we need now is connection and conversation. Like these kids, like we do this.
They don't know how to do that.
They don't know that. Yes. They hate calls and voice. It's all asynchronous. But the live connection, like, you know, we thought, you know, we're victims of the girl boss era. Yeah. You know, we thought capitalism was the cure. But community is the cure.
Community and connection is
absolutely. All power starts with connection. Yeah.
Yeah.
Depression is related to disconnection specifically. It's one of the first things we look for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that is kind of one of my questions is, and I mean, we're jumping around, but that's okay.
I have ADD. Forgive me.
We didn't bring the shrooms.
I know. We should. This whole thing should have been done on shrooms.
Next time.
I would have been talking more slowly.
We can speed it up in post. It's fine.
No, please slow me down in post. I'm so sorry.
No, but, you know, I just think about how right now there's so much backlash and polarization within the DEIB space. And, you know, being who you are, what do you think about where we are? And, it, you know, like it's consciously unbiased, we really think about how we got to just listen to each other. We all have similar goals, most of us at least. Mm-hmm. And it is deeper connections. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's healthier relationships.
Yes.
So that's how we feel is an important way to break the bias. Mm. What do you think?
I want to give a thoughtful answer. Because I've seen it all, right? Especially over time.
Yeah.
You know, when I got into Y Combinator, there were like 13 black women in the world who had raised over $1 million, which was the average, you know, like round size. And that was including Africa. And I wasn't one of them, right? Like, so, and now that I still think it's under 100. You know, the numbers are still like 2% for women founders in VC, 0.2% for black female founders in VC. So, who received VC capital. Those, they have not changed in the last 10 years. And I came up, you know, pre-BLM, pre-Me Too, you know, so I've seen a lot of things, have had said a lot of problematic things said to me. And on the one hand, I'm glad to see people at least attempting to have the conversation. On the other hand, I see sometimes the conversation is completely useless and a waste of everybody's time, energy, and good intentions. I think some of the problem is like the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And so some of the people who, you know, just the first round, because we're figuring out how to get there, it's always an evolution. But I think that, you know, you finally have attention and people don't know what to ask for, right? So, and it feels like at least with some of the initiatives I've seen that it's more performative than it is like truly progressive as far as changing anything. You know, I hate when I'm on calls and they're like, let's do a land acknowledgement, you know, and I'm kind of like, so unless there aren't any Native Americans who we are going to give some reparations to after this call, this is such performative bullshit that only makes you feel better, right? And look now, all the DEI people are getting fired, right?
Like, yeah, that's why I ask.
Well, because you can't improve what you can't measure, right? And like, all we needed was to hire more brown people, hire more women, make the people who work with them, make them feel less alone and more supported. You know what I mean? Like, break your bias, you know, stop thinking like everything has to look the same, you know, go beyond your initial network. This is all we're asking, right? Like, that's it. And instead people are doing, you know, Aunt Jemima is no longer a thing, you know? Yeah. And it's like, you have to, when you get power, when you get a little bit of attention, you have to be focused. You have to know what you're fighting for. We're seeing it with the Dems right now. Like, it can't just be anti-Trump, right? Like, I need you to have a goal and a plan because they sure as hell do.
Yep.
We got 6 Supreme Court seats, people we didn't even vote for changing the rules. Like, they had a long-term plan, and that, you know, you can't just, like, barely push back. You have to have a plan. Yeah. And so some of it's disappointing. You know, like, I'm obviously was really into Black Lives Matter. It was, like, a really good moment to be, kind of like with Me Too. Like, when Harvey Weinstein finally went to jail, I was like, wow, you know, we grew up with, that was acceptable. People thought you got into it to get paid and get laid, you know? So, like, everybody thought it was normal, including women, you know? Like, we were
You're like, I have these tits.
Yeah.
I'm gonna use them.
I'm gonna get something out of it.
Yes.
Leave me alone. But
I thought this was fine.
Right. Everybody did, you know? So it was interesting when people started taking it seriously. But then when you ask for silly things like Aunt Jemima, people don't take it seriously.
Yeah.
Or look at BLM. Girl, all you had to do is watch what the white man do with his nonprofit. Like, you blew it. You had all this money. You didn't have a board, not one board meeting. And now it's delegitimized the entire process.
Yeah.
So this is even Kamala Harris. I know that's our DD. Like, you know, however, Sissy, your mummy is Indian.
Yep.
This is a shameful performance. Your dad is Jamaican. Jamaicans have 3 jobs minimum at one time. I don't know what's the point of getting all the ambition. Head bitch in charge, the highest woman has ever been, and you're letting rights go away on your watch. Well, like, this is a waste of ambition. You got in the room and you're doing the same thing as these white dudes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she's Indian. Like, I know. This performance is unforgivable.
Oh, we have this conversation a lot.
You would not get into Yale with these grades.
Yeah. Exactly.
There's no way my boss would be a million years old and I'm going to be on mute for 4 years instead of showing everybody how I'm going to do things differently. It's just insane. So, like, if you're going to pack a punch, like, don't just swing wildly. And this is what I mean by why mental health is so importantly. You have to take a sacred pause. You have to be intentional. You have to be very selective and protective with your energy so that you are most effective with your energy. I understand people are in pain and just pushing and you have to hear my pain or whatever, but what do you want? There's no way you get in front of a white man and want to make him feel bad or make him feel bored and expect him to give you money or a job. Do your thing. This is a layup.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm from Ghana where you don't not get things because you're black. You know what I mean? So I have to tune out that narrative anyway, right? Mm. And just show up and do the damn thing. I'm a therapist. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I'm a TEDx speaker. What else is new? And I'm black with great tits.
Yeah.
But that's not on the resume. We're at work.
That's there when you meet me.
Yeah.
When you get me in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it's a treat for you, you know? I see it all the time with, like, you know, the gender conversation even. I'm like, wow, you wasted the first 10 minutes trying to make everybody feel bad instead of making us feel good about you. And this is what I've learned from just social interpersonal psychology. People don't like to feel bad for people. They want to feel good about people. So I do hope we can learn from some of the missteps of some of the bigger DEI efforts, and there's still work to be done.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about a time that you actually tell me about the first time that you experienced a microaggression?
You know what's funny? I was actually on the research team for microaggression at Columbia. I went to Teachers College with Dr. Gerald Wing Sue. Shout out to Dr. Sue. And he came up with the term microaggressions when he was on the race initiative with the first Clinton, well, I guess the only Clinton administration back in the 90s. And so microaggressions, there's 3 kinds, micro insults, micro assaults, and micro invalidations. I have by far had the most of the third. And a micro invalidation is where people are like, wow, you are pretty for a black girl, or wow, you're so articulate, right? Because it's the subtle racism of lowered expectations, right? And that's what happens in VC the most, right? They really believe in pattern matching, which is just justified discrimination, right? I'm looking for a Stanford dropout in a hoodie who can code, right? That's what Zuck was. That's what Musk is. I don't, even better if they're on the spectrum. I don't care if they're a sociopath. That's what I want to look for. That's what I want to fund. Mm. So I'm an actual salesperson with traction in a business and knows how to talk to people. They just don't see it. You know, they're just like, can I eat it? Can I fuck it? Can I make money off of it? They just don't see it for me. They don't see me being successful or, you know, what a normal business archetype looks like. So the first time, I mean, I don't know, when I was a child. I remember one time when I was in grad school, I was working at this place called the Core Club, which is like the OG Soho House. Like, it's a members club, but it was like Masters of the Universe. Like, Kenneth Cole was a member, all these big finance guys. And they were like, oh, B, what are you, an actress or something? I'm like, no, I'm actually in grad school studying psychology. And they went, oh, CUNY or John Jay? You know, like, not NYU, you know, just their guess had to be that it was like a local, not a big deal school, right? Like, or at one time I even got in a cab and I remember this guy picked me up in a cab. This was a while ago. I used to live on 29th Street, and the yellow cab, he picked me up and he's like, So where are we going? Brooklyn or the Bronx?
No way. Yes. Oh my God. Like, why?
Like, yes. I'm already home. I live on 29th Street. But the assumptions,
yeah.
right?
Well, did you have to talk? Did you have to
just
say that?
Just ask me, right? Yeah. But I'm glad I know, because this is why I don't like some of the DEI, because now people know what not to say, right? I would rather you say it so I know if I can be safe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If I'm safe about, if my feelings of people who look like me, my family would be safe around you. So now I know. You know what I mean? Now I know. Okay, good. Like, don't talk to this person, or nope, just we can't have a friendly conversation because you're assuming all these things about me. So yeah, I don't take it personally though, because that's the beauty of having to fight. Like, I really know who I am and I really love myself. And, you know, I feel bad for anybody who doesn't.
Yeah. But I mean, you had to have worked at it, right?
Yeah.
Like, tell me some tools. Tell me some tools that you use.
Honestly, the best thing that happened was failure. So when my last company closed, like I said, like we barely over 5 years raised $400,000, like over all 5 years. But in our last year, I had generated over $500,000. We had made over we were doing like $51,000 a month with revenue. No app. I was the only employee. You know, like I had an offshore team that I was waking up in Pakistan. Like I was doing, and like literally VCs were just like, it's too early. And I'm watching people who don't even have a logo business, you know, just mm-hmm. getting funded. Mm-hmm. But I really believed and had internalized that it wasn't enough, you know, and this is the dance that women and brown people do. Too much, too little, mm-hmm. right? I'm never good enough. And it was just, I was living that way, still smiling. They were smiling in my face, still performing. Anyways, where the company closed, because I had been in so much media and television at that point, I was, if you Googled online therapy, I was on the first page, natural SEO. I could never afford, you know, paid advertising through Google, but I got it through what they call earned media. I earned that shit.
Yep.
So I got to meet with like Talkspace and BetterHelp and much bigger competitors who were going to buy my URL. And I met with, and like I said, I had believed that I wasn't, whatever my performance was with my company, it wasn't good enough. And we closed, right? So that must have been true. Girl, tell me why. I get in the room with some of these companies that had 10x the engineers. You know, like we always had a tough issue with our product. Infinity X the funding. And some of them had not made my numbers. I will not say who. And I was like, oh, maybe it was this. Maybe it was this.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't seeing me. I wasn't getting a chance. So now I have the opposite of imposter syndrome, right? Like, I was like, oh, my God, I made meal money. I got money the old-fashioned way through customers. There are companies that have millions in fundings that haven't, you know, had a true customer, a paid customer, and product market fit and all that. I was like, damn. Then Forbes hit me up and they were like, hey, can you talk about failure? And I wrote my first article about what it was like to have your company die. I called it Duvet Day because I was just in bed. You know, I was suicidal at this time. You know, I was getting kicked out of my home that I'd been in for 10 years. And from that, I got a show on Forbes. Like God paid me back, right? Yep. Like, God paid me back, right? That's why I always say I went double for my trouble, because what I was able to see, and also VCs who like were, you know, dismissive of me were like, oh, I've always wanted to work with you. I just didn't like that company, or I didn't like the name, right? And the world, and this is why I love mushrooms, opened up so much more than when I was just focusing this way, trying to do it this way. There was so much else that like life was trying to show me. There's other parts of me that wanted their time in the sun than just like being this brutal grind girl boss lifestyle. And yeah, after that is when I just decided to stop denying my instincts, stop denying my superpowers. I am not meant to be the best product person. I don't need to be the best tech person. I'm the best person to run the difference. I'm the mama.
Yeah.
This all happened because of me. Everything you see that we've done has like happened because of me, right? So I really give myself credit for that, and I hire for my weaknesses, and I'm just very gentle on myself. I a long time ago, I learned to make friends with time. That's helped me a lot, right? Because there's always other stuff happening. There's still some more stuff that I need to learn, people I meet to meet, and it always happens. So like I always tell people, like, I never worry, I just wonder. Like, if I get to a stopping point, like, oh, I've exhausted, I've done everything I know how to do, I wonder what's going to happen next.
Yeah, yeah.
And then someone slides to my DMs or someone's like, want to do mushrooms? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Let's do that.
for sure. I mean, I feel like I love how you just, you know, your professional piece just brings so much of the personal aspect. And the one thing that I keep thinking about is, like, how we overcome these times where we just have to be the bigger person, right? Like, we have to rise above.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to think about a relationship that you have. It could be a work colleague. It can be a mom, a dad, a brother, sister. Do you have brothers?
Yeah.
Or were they sisters?
I'm one of five. Yeah, two brothers, two sisters.
Okay, okay. Yeah. It could be a sibling, a child, a friend. You can tell me who it is. You might. I don't know. Some people don't want to tell me and some people do. But regardless, how do these struggles show up in your everyday lives? Because I think the key here is that this is not just in the workplace. This is something that happens with all different aspects of our life. And tools that we need to overcome it are just going to help us have healthier relationships and those deeper connections that we were talking about earlier.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good question. So how? Which relationship in my life is...
You can think of one.
Uh-huh. That helps me, like, in the journey?
Yeah, no, just think about that relationship and how you still have microaggressions that show up in those relationships. And what tools do you use?
So I'm going to shake the table with this one because it's kind of like, this is a personal thing that I'm still working through, right? So, and this is also, I feel like a lot of people can relate to this because mental health was already on the decline, like pre-COVID. But I truly think, I blame most things on Mark Zuckerberg. I truly think it happened the 10 years before that, which is when social went mobile. So when people started being able to look at the feed and, you know, then it's a constant comparison. And then a lot of people, regular people, started to have performance anxiety. And comparison is a thief of joy. So a lot of people are suffering depression and just aware of what they should be doing, what they should be doing. And my life has definitely been that as like the face of the business. So it's tough. And also, like, I have really poor boundaries. I'm a therapist at heart. My business is connecting with people. So I got overloaded with other people's energy early on. And I have really bad performance energy because a lot of times people want me to be loving and fun. And like my natural instinct, even though like I'm a party girl, I really like my alone time. Like I need it. Like even when I have kids, I still want to have my own apartment. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to work that out because you can't, right?
Please tell me how that's done.
That's what everybody says. Well, that's why I worked hard to get money because I just need to retreat. Like I'm really big on, they talk about different kinds of therapy. This is a bad joke, but they always say, oh, do you do CBT or DBT? And I'm like, oh, my coping mechanism is IMM, which is isolate, medicate, masturbate. I'll see y'all later. I'm out. I'm going home. I don't want to talk to nobody. Like, even now, my girlfriend's staying with me, and I'm really like, oh, no. Like, I have to retreat. So my biggest thing to navigate this thing is, number one, invest in your friendships. Like, when my company died, I had been such a shitty friend. I started in my 20s. My whole 20s, I was chasing men and money, period. Like, I was really big on business. And I was just that bad friend. And when my company died, like, people who I hadn't shown up to their weddings for really reached out to me. Even to this day, my dad thinks I just do something with computers. You know, he has no idea what, because he does not know me for that identity. Mm-hmm. My friends don't give a shit what's happening in my company. They're like, yeah, but you're on TV. You know, like it's cool to them, you know? So it's nice to have, you know, exercise different muscles, right, in your body, like allow different aspects of you. So I'm really, like, what helps me the most is talking to my friends who aren't in startups. Like the best thing is like going home to Houston or going home to Ghana and just like, just not hanging out with like hyper ambitious people, truthfully.
Oh my gosh. I am so with you on that.
Yeah.
Because one, it's exhausting.
It's exhausting.
And two, it overextends yourself in just that one area.
Yes.
And I'm sorry if you are not a multifaceted person and not able to bring all of that identity into what you're doing.
Yeah.
For work. It doesn't resonate.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
You can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can tell. So I'm really big on that, but I do need to retreat. So it's like, oh, how do your relationships? Yeah. I'm like, oh, I got to go back to be mountain. And just meditate on top there. But yeah, I really am big on my alone time, but I'm working on it.
Okay, so you say that you're working on your boundaries, but to me,
I'm working on my boundaries.
Yeah, but when you say that you want your alone time, that's a boundary.
But
that's,
I froze my eggs a long time ago, and it's going to be time to have kids soon, and they don't know what alone time is.
Oh, well, they'll learn. You will teach them. Trust me. My kids know.
Yeah?
My kids know. And my daughter is going to be 12.
Oh, well,
so she's at that age of, she would definitely use your service. When it's time for her, she's going to be calling.
Awesome.
And it's important because they need people that they can trust and they can talk to. But the girl appreciates alone time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that you instill it.
You have to tap in. And this is like, even in therapy, when we say like, when it comes to decision making, because like decisions have consequences, always HALT. And HALT stands for hungry, angry, lonely, tired, right? Because when you're in any of those states, you're disconnected from your power, right? You're just not yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's, I often
especially
try to,
hungry.
Especially all of them, you're lacking. If you're thirsty, you need water. If you're hungry, if you need food. If you're lonely, you need connection. You know, like pay attention to what your body is trying to tell you and don't try to power through it. So I'm really big on, because I used to try to go out, but I'd cussing somebody out, right? I'm like, yeah, you know, yeah. Getting advice with my friends. And I'm like, y'all just want me to be the party person. I just need to be the introvert that I am.
Yeah. And then I'll come back on it. And I will join you for happy hour when I'm ready.
But I need to be rested. So that's what resourced means. Reconnect to your source, like, and just know what you need. Know what you need and what makes you feel better when you feel bad. And understand where your triggers come from, too, because, you know, all of our triggers are related to our traumas, you know? So just give yourself space to do what you need and adjust accordingly.
Yeah. Okay, I have a last question for you.
Okay.
If your life had a pause button or a rewind button, what would you choose?
Pause.
Why?
Pause, period. First of all, we call it a sacred pause. So I actually studied in Sevilla, and so that's why I speak Spanish. But, you know, the bullfighting culture is still alive and well there. Mm-hmm. And the torero, which is the guy with the cape, is always afraid of the pause. So bulls are reactive, right? They've been trained to see red and to go for red, right?
Yeah.
And so that's when they get to do the dance for a long time. But when the bull stops, that's the worst time, right? Because, again, when we're reactive or we're punching, we just are not going to think well. But when the torero is most scared, it's when the bull pauses because they're like, oh, there's nothing behind that, right? There's, you know, and they're accessing the situation and focusing in and tuning out the noise, living above the noise and just like focusing in. And that's where you need to be. Mm. When you don't know what to do, pause, like just take a break, go to nap, take a snack. Like I'm really big on the sacred pause for sure. And other people could wait. It's going to be fine. Everybody will be better if I'm better.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we just can't wait to see even what happens with fast forward for you.
Oh my God, I feel like it's already fast forward. I would never rewind because my 20s were tough. I'm 39 now. I'm turning 40 this year.
You're going to have the big 4.
I'm going to have the big 4.
Are you going to have a party?
Yeah, I'm just now planning it.
So when's your birthday?
August 23rd.
Oh, it's coming up.
It's coming up.
How do you feel?
I have to be better about it because all year I've been like, I'm going to be 40 this year. I'm going to be 40 this year. But I did my thing in my 30s, right? So I do need to appreciate the last year and like what it means. And mentally I'm like, I don't know. Should I be married? Should I have a mortgage? Like, but I don't know. You know, New York, you can kind of live in like Peter Pan land for a long time.
100%.
But all my girlfriends have said their 40s are lit. All my guy friends are like, oh, this starts or that starts. But all my girlfriends are like, oh, no, it's where it's at. So
I am
excited.
With you. Yes, it is. I mean, I had a different 30s because I had young kids.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
But when I tell you that I feel like I have space now, it's in my 40s because they're like, you know, they're older.
They're bigger now.
Yeah.
How old is the youngest one?
My youngest one is 7.
Okay, yeah, so they're not pooping. They don't need you.
No, he's not. I mean, sometimes, but he's a boy, so whatever.
seriously. God bless them. I just don't know.
You just don't know, and it's fine. That's their deal, not mine.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I mean, you're 40s, and I feel like everyone's now telling me that because I'm going to be closer to 50s
really?
Soon.
Really? Wow.
But your 50s are even better than your 40s mm-hmm. because you just keep learning more about yourself and being more confident in who you are. And there's nothing to hide, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Nothing to hide.
It's something that you can't understand. You know, in my 20s, I wouldn't have believed it, but it's just something you can't understand without like the distance. An appreciation for time.
And the experiences.
And all the experiences. Yeah. Like, you know, it just all goes together. Don't you think, like, if you look back, you can be like, oh, I can see why that happened. Da, 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 da.
Oh, yeah.
Thank God that already happened, right? I've done it, you know?
Right, like, right. Mm-hmm. It all makes sense. Like, you know.
It does.
The whole story of why. I was like, if not, I would have been divorced by now and probably living in 3 different places. Like, there's just so much. And that wasn't meant for me.
Exactly.
Because something else is coming.
Something better. Something better, something you
better
could have done.
Better or worse, I don't know. But
it's wild.
You know.
Yeah, I have this show with Roy Wood Jr. that came in my lap. You know, like just like things come, like, and you can work really hard, and the universe will work with you too if you just show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, B, if people want to find you, how do they find you?
Well, my name is B Arthur. That's my real name. There is another B Arthur if you Google.
Really? Okay.
It turns out, yeah. Some the younger kids don't know because they weren't raised with the glory that is the Golden Girls. But if you put B. Arthur Therapy, that's my website, barthurtherapy.com. And we are launching The Difference this fall. So if you go to thedifference.co, you can get our wait list to get our warm line. It's not a hot line, but a warm line. Should feel like a warm hug. And yeah, I'm really, really excited to just bring mental health care to the masses. So really worth the work. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, B.
Thanks for listening to Break the Bias. To learn more about our special guest and to get show notes, please visit consciouslyunbiased.com/podcasts. Consciously Unbiased also offers interactive, unique DEIB learning experiences that you can check out on our website, consciouslyunbiased.com. And if you liked the show, please share with a friend and subscribe and rate Break the Bias on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.